All right, George, here we go.
Great.
Feel pumped? Feel good?
Pretty pumped.
All right. We're not going to put this in.
This is just us getting ready.
Everybody listening, we're not going to put this in the podcast. This is me warming up my voice.
Edit right over this.
All right, folks, welcome back to another episode of Worst Scene, the podcast where we watch movies, two of them to be exact, a great one and a not so great one, and then choose the worst scene in the great film and the best scene in the bad one, and then decide which one is better, that bad scene from a great film or that good to great scene from a bad film. I'm one of your hosts, Richard, and I'm here with another one. I'm not here, to be clear. We are, as always, social distancing here on the podcast. I am connected via Zoom to a man about 3 miles away, who is your co-host. Why don't you say your name?
I am George.
Thank you, George.
I feel like there was something else that I'd wanted to say there, but I forgot what it was in the moment, so let's just keep moving on.
Yeah, well, we'll keep going. So, of course, this episode is between Do the Right Thing, Do the Right Thing is the great film, and Driving Miss Daisy is the bad film. And so
this, I would say, in this episode, I would say that if you were the Academy voters, you would have it flipped around as to which was the great film and which was the not great film.
You would have that flipped around.
But we're going to get into that. I think we're going to get into that plenty in a little bit. So I'll just let you keep going.
We can both keep going. It's the joy of talking. What you're getting here, folks, is what everybody's been waiting for, which is two white guys diving in to movies that purport to be about racism and the black experience, one of which is about the white experience of feeling good about how racism is gone away. So you're going to get us talking about that, and since we're not really qualified to talk about a lot of it, we will obviously try to talk about it in the ways that we can. I know I can talk about racism in so much as I don't have to face it in any way whatsoever, because I benefit from the extreme unearned privilege of being a white man in America. And so I can talk about how shitty I am for that. I can talk about how a terrible society is to give me that unearned privilege. And we can talk about ways that we as white men can contribute to ending that cycle. You're going to hear two white dudes talk about this movie, and we're probably going to say occasional stupid things, but then we'll edit those out. We'll say occasional smart things, and we will then copy and paste them so that they appear 3 or 4 times so that you nod at our sage wisdom and our realizations of things. But, you know, I grew up very poor. I grew up in a trailer park. My mom had me when she was 15. I grew up in Appalachia. And, you know, there's this book, and I'm just really going to get into a semi-political rant here. There's this book called Hillbilly Elegy by this dipshit. There's no need to name him. Just other dipshit is fair enough. Where he grew up poor in the South as well. But through his gumption and through his grandma's lessons, he grew up to be an investment banker. And he's very proud of that accomplishment. It shows how all it takes is a little hard work and elbow grease and
some bootstrapping. Am I right?
All you have to do is bootstrap your way to becoming a hundreds of millionaire, and that's fucking bullshit. In so many ways, and you know, my growing up poor took away no privilege for me. I just, as I already mentioned earlier, get treated as the default by other white men who have power. It makes it easier for me to get jobs. It makes it easier for me to get opportunities. It has throughout to get opportunities to advance my career. Because of those people, I fit the part. You know, my mom never had to sit me down and tell me I needed to be careful around the police. No employees, no security ever suspiciously follow me around the grocery store or a shopping center. People don't angrily question whether I should be staying in the hotel where I'm staying, whether I belong in the neighborhood where I'm at. They don't come up to me and ensure that the place I'm staying in front of is my home. Cops don't accuse me of fitting the description. If I had lived in New York during stop and frisk, I would not have faced that humiliation of being suspicious, quote unquote, to the police and being continually stopped and searched for no fucking reason. My life is just made so easy in ways that I can see and in ways that I can't see, that I can't even begin to understand because I am white. I have conscious bias. I have unconscious bias. I benefit from it. And that cycle has to end. And the best way to start ending it for as white men, the best way we can, I think, contribute to ending it is to talk about it, to name it, and to stop benefiting other people from it. It doesn't mean that you're not nice to other white people. It just means that you make sure that you're not just treating other white people and white men as the default in life. Anyway, that's my opening rant, George.
Fuck you. Yeah, throw to me.
Hey, what do you have to say, George?
I didn't grow up in Appalachia, but I feel this now. We were talking before this, and we've had a few conversations. I'm there with you. It's hard to actually say anything that means anything, because it's not my place to say anything other than stop.
Yeah.
Stop saying that shit. Being able to say to a family member, that's fucking racist, shut up. I don't know, man. I am, as of this recording, 42 years old. I have been ashamed to be a white person many times in my life. And where we are now, there's nothing I can say that's going to be any kind of eloquent or any kind of important or anything. It's just, I don't matter. What I have to say doesn't matter. My actions can make a difference, and yours can too. And that's it. This is not going to change itself. Silence is complicity, right? I don't know. I don't want to just be someone who's parroting fucking slogans, but Jesus Christ, to my fellow honkies out there, you've got to fucking do something. We have to do something. This is a fucking shame. It's I don't know. I've been struggling with what to say all day, and this is not what I intended to say. Not anywhere near eloquent. But so what? Fuck being polite, fuck being nice, fucking asking permission, fuck going through channels. Take action in your communities. If you can't get out and protest, you can make a difference. You can still donate to causes. There are a ton of great causes out there. Jesus Christ, like the NAACP has local chapters in probably all of your neighborhoods. If you look around, you might have multiple organizations in your city. There's the ACLU, there's the Southern Poverty Law Center. There are places that are smaller, more grassroots than those three that you can give to. There are places like, look around your community. If you can't get out of the house, if you have health concerns, which is real, which is where I am, I'm sitting here watching shit on my computer and like trying to make a difference with my wallet. And I feel guilty about it. And fuck, who cares? It's not my story. I don't need to be the center of it just because I'm a fucking white guy. So shut up. That's it. Enough about me. Yeah.
Yeah. enough about us. But we had to say something. Our voices are unimportant.
Yeah. If we had just shown up and done, you know, all right, so tonight's good movie is Ghostbusters and our bad movie is, you know, Fletch Lives. It's like, oh, who fucking cares? It's, you know.
Yeah.
And we also have several other episodes that have been edited and are, you know, ready to be released. We just this doesn't make sense. It's been a few weeks since we've been here together and it's, our fucking country's on fire. It should be on fire. I mean, we should all be angry. And this is just a goofy fucking podcast about movies by two goofballs. Although I would say this is not the first time that you've been political on the show, Richard. I've been political on the show too, but it's not.
I mean, I can't wait to get into the Confederate statues being torn down. The one that forever. I mean,
that's my favorite thing.
Robert E. Lee should have been absolutely Robert E. Lee. What a piece of shit who was also not a very good general. Beyond that. Who just because he kept his hair combed and he was pretty, it gets elevated to this position of this fucking respect, this noble general of a lost cause, this noble general who turned down command of the U.S. Army to go fucking hang out in Virginia defend nothing but slavery, to defend the ownership of human beings, the only reason that Confederacy existed. There's a good story about Ulysses S. Grant and Robert E. Lee. Ulysses S. Grant, for so many years, was treated as some sort of drunk butcher who just lucked into winning the war because he had more people. And then as a bumbling president, and most of those things come out of a lost cause narrative that treat Grant that way because he was really the last president until, barely FDR to even treat to even have any concern for civil rights. He was the last president to attempt to tap down on the Ku Klux Klan. He was the last president to actually try to fulfill the initial promise of the North winning the war. And so as a result, he gets turned into someone who was not competent, which is not true at all. So something that really illustrates Lee versus Grant is that by the time, of course, Grant is in command of the entire army, there are many battalions of black soldiers or many units of black soldiers in the U.S. Army. And they are, of course, just as soldiers do, some of them get captured by the South, get captured by the Confederacy, and get turned into prisoners of war, where they're, of course, treated much worse than their white counterparts. Of course, it's the South's opinion they shouldn't even be soldiers. They should be returned to they should be returned as property. So then, whenever there was the time to be a prisoner of war transfer, and the South really needed people to fight the war, they were running out, and Grant was willing to do an even trade of soldiers in prison to the Confederacy, but on the condition that black soldiers were returned equal to their white counterparts. And Lee, in 1864, refused, calling them property. And Grant said, well, you will get none of your fucking soldiers then. And that was the end of that. That is a story that really illustrates the utter human garbage that is Robert E. Lee. So convinced he was that these black men who were soldiers, that they should just be property, that he wouldn't even do a prisoner of war exchange. With Grant. So fuck Robert E. Lee, fuck the Confederacy, fuck all that shit. I don't think that's anything controversial to say,
no.
But it's just, people aren't just like created by their time. Not everyone in the 1800s is just an utter piece of shit. Some of them are less pieces of shit than others, and some of them are more pieces of shit, even if they have a nice white beard and well-kept hair. Wear a cool gray coat and don't drink, they may still be awful. So anyway,
that wasn't a half an hour rant. I was worried.
No, no, So we can stop there and we can actually talk about our two films.
Yeah.
I don't know how much of that we'll keep and how much we'll cut out. But
it's important to just at least say it. If you guys hear any explosions in the background, my neighborhood, 4th of July starts the first week of June, and it's all illegal fireworks being shot into the air. It's exciting. As always, a great time to be alive and to be an American. I just want to kind of say something else off the top. We have been planning to do this episode for a long time. This is one of, when we put the concept of this show together, this is one that we had maybe had laid out for the first year. And it was the kind of thing where something comes up and we would, you know, move things around. And, we had always wanted to do the right thing. And especially after, the Oscars 2 years ago when it was Black Klansman versus, Green Book. Look for that one coming sometime in the near future, although I'm really not excited about watching Green Book again. I don't know. There's some, it's my least favorite of the Farrelly Brothers road trip movies, I'll say that right now. And you'll hear that joke again when we do the Green Book episode. So
maybe we should just make that a hallmark of every episode that we do.
Yeah. I'll use that joke from now on until the day that you pour dirt over my dead body.
What a day that'll be.
I'm going to be talking about Do the Right Thing right now. And I want to say that this is one of my all-time favorite movies. This came out when I was 11 years old, and I saw it that year. I saw it, it came out in June. I think I saw it either late that year or early the next year. I remember seeing it. My dad rented it and we watched it. And it was the most exciting film I'd ever seen in my life. And I know that before this I'd seen the Star Wars and the Star Treks and the Indiana Joneses and all that stuff. And it's a different kind of excitement. This is the first time I'd seen a film where the actual filmmaking was the electricity. It wasn't some dude getting chased by a boulder. It wasn't like some giant shark. It wasn't, you know, some alien thing. It was the actual camera and the performances and the colors and I'd never been that aware of actual filmmaking. This movie, it just from start to finish pops. It is, and it's kind of crazy because Spike Lee is this sort of hybrid director. So much of his visual style and the way he moves, he gets the camera move, it almost feels like a musical from the 50s. He's got this like classicist thing and some very staginess in the way that he shoots things or frames things. So you're always working. Like as a viewer, you're always working. You're always being engaged. In Do the Right Thing, there's never a shot where it looks like, well, this is just, you know, having Richard, you and I having made a couple things together. Sometimes you have to use the shot that you have. It's like, well, that shot didn't work out. That one had a boom shadow. That one just didn't get developed right. So we just have to use this. There is no shots like that in all of Do the Right Thing. Every shot is purposeful. Every shot is right. I get a little in this kind of stammering mode because I love this filmmaking so much.
I mean, it should have been nominated for cinematography.
Yeah. Ernest Dickerson shot this using mostly natural light. And of the other films, you look at the other stuff that was nominated for cinematography that year, there's not one that stands out. Like, yeah, there's some big names like Haskell Wexler and, you know, this Michael Ballhaus and some great, great cinematographers who were nominated, but for things that weren't as virtuosic as this film. This is from top to bottom, everyone going all out. Every member of the cast, the crew, watching the behind the scenes, you see like the amount of work that went into creating that little corner in Bed-Stuy, and you know that the exterior of the Korean store is a facade, and that Saul's was built on an empty lot. And I don't know. There are very few films that are like this. It's also one of the greatest summer films ever made. It's the joy of the filmmaking, the propulsive virtuosity of the filmmaking. Yeah, this is a movie I could literally watch this film every week for the rest of my life and die a very happy person. It's just great. We went to see it late last year. It was the 30th anniversary screening at the Castro. And I'd seen it not too long before that. And then, but just to get a little bit of a refresher, I got up at 6 a.m. today to watch it before going to work. And it's not a bad way to start the day. And the thing is that as soon as that the opening, as soon as like the Public Enemy hits, I start getting teary-eyed. I start, because it's just, I know the ride, I know what's coming, and I love every bit of it, even the uncomfortable stuff. It's, anyway, that's my I'm ranting about this, but
it's raving. Better to rant about a movie. You're raving about a movie while I rant about the Confederacy.
Yeah, so Do the Right Thing is a, is a great, great, great fucking movie. I've got two pages of scattered notes on this. There's all these little amazing things too. I keep saying amazing. Get the thesaurus. Let's keep that in. All of the major characters, actually quite a few of the supporting characters, all get a chance to shine, which you don't see. There's often like a perfunctory character who's like, oh, they're here and they're gone. We see a little bit of that with Driving Miss Daisy, although there's not a ton of characters in that. But I don't know, this movie's 2 hours long. It doesn't feel like 2 hours. It feels real short. It just like rips by. And so it got two Oscar nominations, and it was Danny Aiello for supporting. And that, you know, if he's incredible. He had a good career, and I think that you know, he'd been working since the 70s by the time he did this film, so he was almost to his second decade as a working actor. And he did like Jackie Chan's first American movie in the 80s, but I think this is it. This is kind of this. I think that in the script and the way that Spike Lee wanted it to be, I think that it was a little bit more black and white as far as Sal's racism. And I think that Danny Aiello pushed for that to be softened. And I don't have a stance on this. I just know that it's a great performance. And the other nomination was for the screenplay, which is, it's a killer. This screenplay is a killer. And looking at the other stuff that was nominated for original screenplay, I don't know that I would look at any of those and say like, yeah, that holds up now. That's what I, yeah, of course, Dead Poets Society, you know. No, I think you look back at Dead Poets Society. I remember seeing Dead Poets Society a couple years after it come out, and my take on it was, what's all the hubbub? Why is everyone so crazy about that? Well, it's the love of them. But like, I didn't understand why everyone was so nuts about it. You know, good performances and all that, but it's like an elevated after-school special. I don't know. I don't want to insult it too much because the director, Peter Weir, is a truly great filmmaker, but compared to this, I think everything that was against it, everything that this was up against has faded. And it was a weird bunch of films that got nominated for Best Picture this year. This was not nominated for Best Picture. Yeah, I don't know. And then also, this is a very weird, we're not really doing the format this time around, but that's fine. But this is, yeah, I don't know. I could tell you like some trivia stuff and I don't really want to. I just want to talk about like how great this is. This is just, I love the score of this film. I have the score and I listen to it frequently, and it's just, the last time I was in New York, I just listened to that nonstop the whole time I was there. And it made me feel very happy. And I love Spike Lee. I love his films. I there are knocks against him, and I get it. Sometimes he's not really great at writing for women, and sometimes there are things that haven't aged as well. But like, I remember going to see Mobetta Blues in the theater, and I was just like, man, this is so incredible, because it has almost a 40s film noir, early 50s film noir feel. And then seeing Girl 6 in the theater, which is a real mess. I mean, that is a mess of a movie. But the music is great. The performances are great. But then, you know, seeing Clockers in the theater, seeing that on a huge screen, and like the opening credits and all the Stevie Wonder music, I've been a fan of Spike Lee since I was 11. I've been a fan of Public Enemy since I was 11. This movie is also one of the few films that I saw as a kid that made me think, hey, I want to make a movie. I want to try to do that. Oddly enough, it was this and the low-budget horror film Terror Vision. So this is the movie. It was like, wow, this is incredibly beautiful. This is, and then Terror Vision, I saw it. I was like, oh, I can do that. Maybe not as funny as that, but I can try to do that. That's a dopey little thing to add in, but that's what it is. Let's talk about this movie. I'm done rambling. I don't want to ramble anymore.
Let's talk about it. Let's talk about a worst scene, or do the right thing. So before I get into that, I appreciate that that Sal's racism is more nuanced, softened, mm-hmm. because it's, regardless of how much of that was in the script or how much Danny Aiello pushed to make the racism softer, it makes the racism, I think, more powerful. Because it's not just coming from a purely racist person. It's someone who is still racist, despite the fact that he also is friends with people in the community, despite the fact that he's had a pizza place there for 25 years, despite the fact that he has, to some degree, been part of that community and knows the kids, saw them grow up, knows the older people in the community, as he talks about, saw them get older. Adding that makes it all the more real. He's still a fucking racist, right. And he's still a, at the end of the day, he has not learned enough to escape being a racist, nor has his oldest son.
Especially his oldest son. But Spike points to there's the line in the dialogue where I've seen these people, or I've fed these people. And then, you know, these people.
Yeah, these people. There's still a otherness. Generation.
Yeah,
as a separation there. It's like he is a almost like a father figure to them, even though all he's doing is fucking selling them pizza.
It's like a light take on white savior, or it's like a loose white savior kind of thing.
Yeah. As we talked about, this movie is so beautifully shot. The whole thing feels like it's on a soundstage.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing feels like it was constructed.
Yeah.
It's amazing that this was happening just on the street, although, as you noted, the pizza place was built on a lot, and the Korean grocery store is like a facade. Yeah. But
they're
still,
both on the same block. It's like
still
it's an actual block in Bed-Stuy.
And the fact that the light is so even, mm-hmm. Even though it was raining so much when they were filming, and it's supposed to be the hottest day of the year, and it all happens over the course of a day, so you have to have the light feel like you're progressing mm-hmm. through the day, even though you're mostly shooting with natural light, it's an incredible feat from an
that alone
cinematography standpoint.
That wins an Oscar as opposed to just getting nominated. I mean, Jesus Christ, what a towering feat.
Yeah, It's beautiful. The movie is, every shot looks purposeful, as you know, that every shot just looks beautiful. You feel the heat of the day. I feel hot watching all those scenes when they're outside, just the sweat dripping off everybody's faces. Just, if you can tell it's fucking humid, 95 degrees outside. It's a film about just a day in the life of a neighborhood that feels epic, which when we compare it to Driving Miss Daisy in a bit, which is a film that takes place over 25 years, that just feels small. You have an epic movie that takes place on one block over the course of a day versus a movie that takes place throughout the city of Atlanta, though mostly in one house, over 25 years and still feels incredibly small. But we'll get to that. But what's with Do the Right Thing, because it's so beautiful and because it all works so well, it's difficult to choose a worst scene, as it so often is when our favorite movies come up. But I'm going to go with a scene that has Sal in it as my worst scene. And I was going to say, well, before we actually say the worst scene, there's part of me that was almost going to say that the actual, like Samuel L. Jackson's part as the radio DJ is the only part that dates the movie, really. It's the part that everything else, he's talking about Jerry curls. He's talking about kind of things in the moment. So it's the only part of the movie that doesn't feel like it's just timeless. I still love his character and I still love everything that's going on. And when he's talking at the very end about the mayor coming to the neighborhood, it's damage to property will not be tolerated, which is just so incredibly relevant to right now. So it actually doesn't date it at all. It actually just shows.
Exactly. Exactly.
Which is why I talked myself out of using that, because it's great. So my worst scene is Sal and Jade sitting in the booth while they're eating pizza together. Of course, Jade is actually Spike Lee's sister, in real life. But Jade and Sal sitting there, and Sal flirting with her, and I know there's a part of that that shows that even this racist man can be attracted to a black woman. There's a lot going on there. It just creeps me out listening to him compliment her eyes. And
the eyes thing is woo boy.
And her kind of enjoying him, this old man flirting with her. Tonally, it feels weird compared to the rest of the movie to me. And then when Spike Lee takes her aside and tells her not to come back and eat at the pizza place, that part just doesn't, that of all the different scenes in the movie, that stands out the least to me and sticks out the most as not being absolutely necessary. And so that scene between Sal and Jade with him flirting with her as they both just sit and hang out and talk is my least favorite scene. There you go.
All right. God, I have all these notes about things like about how a lot of white critics were blaming Spike for the possibility that he was going to make a film that incited riots, and that the idea that like a black audience couldn't go to a movie and not burn the theater down because of this. It's just, it's insane. We're doing worse scene now. Got it. I think mine is really a weird one. And it's nothing to do with the actual filmmaking. It's more to do, it's to do with the actual on-set filmmaking. So my pick is Rosie Perez's nude scene. Because I know how uncomfortable she was during it, and I think that it was not a safe set for her. I think it was not a cleared set. I think the story is that she was crying during her nude scene.
Wow.
And she's, you know, I think it was, she's a supporter of Spike and a supporter of the movie, but in the moment, it was not great And that is the one real bummer for me in this movie. And so that is my pick. It was easy. I knew this before I rewatched it because I know the story. And she's fucking great in this movie. She's great in this. She's great in a lot of things. And but hearing that really sucked. And so, yeah, there's my pick.
Right, and so we both chose scenes in which we felt uncomfortable because of the interactions with women within them, further proving our status as... Right.
Yeah, and I mean, Spike has been knocked for his depiction of women. I think Rosie Perez is like a terrific character in this. I think that there's nothing one note about what she does here, but... You're right. I mean, to cut you off and tell everyone that we're not creeps. it's weird to like say like, no, don't worry, I'm not a creep. It usually means that you're a creep.
And that's the traditional thing for a creep to say.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm not a cop is exactly what a cop would say.
Yeah. terrific. Wow, well, we picked different stuff, and that's cool.
That's what you want. So it's almost entirely based upon at least your choice that Do the Right Thing might not win between these two movies in terms of the worst scene and it being better than the best scene in our next
film. Yeah, yeah.
Which is Driving Miss Daisy.
Yeah.
So I'll talk a bit about Driving Miss Daisy. Obviously came out same year. It won Best Picture. It is trite. It is fluff. It is like cotton candy. You just bite into it and it melts away. It's a movie that's not an awful movie. It's just not a Best Picture winner. If it was just a story of like Morgan Freeman and Jessica Tandy hanging out and being friends, kind of like a bucket list type movie where they drive around the South together, like going out to eat crab. They're both great actors, and interestingly, two great actors that really gained their fame when they both were old. And like Jessica Tandy did some TV in the 50s and early 60s and then vanished until, you know, the early 80s when she became a big star. And Morgan Freeman did Electric Company, and then,
was it Street Smarts? The one with
Street Smarts was
it was like mid-80s, and he like plays this like killer pimp. Where it was, you were already going there. I mean.
But no, you got us there even faster. That was his breakout, and that was 2 years before this came out. So two actors who became famous when they were older. That became truly famous when they were older, and I feel like that has to make you appreciate it more, like becoming famous after you've tried so hard
to get there.
Yeah, it's a feeling that must be to be older and to make it when you've got to be feeling like, you know, it's not like, you know, Morgan Freeman was paying the bills with his acting, he was doing stage work, but you have to begin to feel like you'll never be famous, and then suddenly you're 50 and you very much are, and then you're a huge star for the rest of your life.
Was he 50 when they did this movie?
Yeah, he was. I think he was 53, maybe 52 or 53.
Jesus, wow!
He did a good job aging him up.
Yeah. This one did this win Best Makeup? I think.
I think so.
Yeah.
Someone that did a bad job aging up was Dan Aykroyd, who I feel like aged like 10 years.
Immediately.
He was watching him age 10 years every scene while.
Or it's just that they aged the other two very gracefully because they had a happier life than he did.
Oh, yeah. Because they had each other. They had each other while he was alone.
It was like him and Patti LuPone, who was a racist. So
Driving Miss Daisy really is a kind of. White people feeling good about racism movie. It's a to a certain degree. Like racism used to be a bigger problem. It's not now.
Right, right.
There's a few things about it that really take me there. One, it's when, I mean, there's some nuance to the scene where mm-hmm. where Jessica Tandy goes to see Martin Luther King speak and right. sit at the table, and then she wishes that she'd invited Morgan Freeman in to see him too. Instead, he sat in the car, listened to the radio. She's learning about her own racism as this happens. Martin Luther King was an incredibly unpopular figure with white people. Just the notion of this old, there's just something about his treatment there that is irksome as just this figure of hope that everyone flocked to see. It gave Dan Aykroyd's character an out, kind of like, I can't go because I won't get business anymore. So if you're a good white person, maybe you have to worry about how other white people perceive you, so you act a different way. I mean, it's also true to how people ended up having to act, but there's just a certain amount of everything in it lands kind of softly, and not because it's happening over 25 years. It lacks a punch. It brings some more. I mean, it's just not Jessica Tandy's character is Jewish, which adds a progressive element to this, but it doesn't necessarily play into it very much, other than her playing Mahjong in a couple of scenes, and then the bombing of the temple in Atlanta. But that bombing doesn't, again, none of these things really land because it's a 90-minute movie.
It's polite as hell.
The movie is polite. The bombing just happens kind of outside of her vision.
Yeah.
It's something that's in the background. I just feel like it's just kind of a nice movie. Everybody's nice.
Sure.
Things are nice. I mean, there's some nuance to the characters, but there's just no world where this should be a best picture. As Spike Lee said in a quote that you gave me, George. Nobody's talking about motherfucking Driving Miss Daisy, and this was in 2015. That film is not being taught in film schools all across the world. Like, Do the Right Thing is. Nobody's discussing Driving Miss Motherfucking Daisy, and how wrong he was. Because here we are right now.
Sorry, Spike. Sorry, Spike.
But yeah, it's just kind of like it's not awful.
The score is awful.
Holy bad. Shit, that is very bad.
What are they trying to reference? Is it the shortening bread? Is that there's some kind of a sing-song thing they're doing with the score that's supposed to evoke something? And I was watching it last night. It's like, oh. This is annoying the piss out of me. And then I watched, Billy and the, sorry, one second, folks. The Natural Spiritual Orchestra doing the score for Do the Right Thing, which is truly great and virtuosic, whereas this thing is just, sounds very similar to a lot of other movies, like, say, Secret of My Success, starring Michael J. Fox. It's just got that sound of the late 80s, and with a slight southern twinge, and it's really annoying.
I mean, it's just like Hans Zimmer maybe wasn't cut out to do a movie like this.
Oh, this is Hans Zimmer?
Yeah,
because Hans Zimmer kind of like what the fuck? What's the guy who did Star Wars?
Yeah,
John
Williams. John
Jesus.
Williams.
Holy cow, folks. I've been up since 5 a.m. I'm a little tired. It's 6 a.m. right now as we're recording this, so I've only been awake for an hour. But yeah, so like Hans and John, they both kind of sample a bit. Is that fair? They riff. They take some stuff. They're like early hip hop DJs, except they're old white guys.
Yeah, and they're sampling from like for John Williams. He's essentially sampling from classical music from the 1700s.
Yes, exactly. So anyway, the music is the thing that was the most egregious for me. Well, that, and it's just like 10 minutes in, I wrote, I hate this kind of storytelling. And then it changed a little bit, and I didn't hate it as much. I actually did not hate this film the way that I thought I would. I would be interested to see it performed live. There is another version of this. I don't know if you're aware of it, Richard. It's James Earl Jones and Angela Lansbury, and it's actually a filmed stage production of it.
Because that's how it started.
Yes, this was a Pulitzer Prize winning play. I would be curious to see that version of it.
Me too. I'd be interested to see. I imagine the play digs further into her being Jewish. I imagine it gets more into the complexities of the actual story and what's going on, the complexities of racism in the South at the time. Oh, you doubt it. Okay. I'm giving it too much credit.
Like that they would cut that stuff out for the movie.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense.
I feel like they would pump it up
too much.
I feel like probably the scene with the two racist cops was added for the movie.
Added. You know,
it's like Alec Baldwin in Glenn Ross, the movie. It was like, it was, add this for the movie. I feel the only reason that I want to see a stage play is that I like people miming a steering wheel. I'm imagining they're going to do it the way they do Our Town, where there's no sets, everyone just mimes everything, right? That's the right take on this material.
Is that what you're telling me about? Because James Earl Jones' steering wheel miming in this version, from what you've read, is incredible. Yeah. Like, you forget he's not in a car. That's how real it feels while he's driving.
Yes. And for the Broadway version, they hired Yakov Smirnoff to play the voice of the horn of the car. Honk, honk. What a country.
And that really, the what a country, really.
Yeah.
That sums up what the movie's about.
The play came out in 1987. The movie came out in 1989. This is Yakov country.
That's so
crazy. Well, I guess it's Smirnoff country also, if you like vodka. It was a dumb add-on. Dumb tag. Good.
And of course, Morgan Freeman played. Morgan Freeman was in the off-Broadway production.
Right. And like, look, he's fucking great in this. Like, Morgan Freeman's a great actor. You know what's amazing? It's like he did this, and then a couple years later, he's playing like way younger in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
No, he is.
Like he plays like way more virile.
You are right.
But he's great in this. Actually, the acting is uniformly good in this movie. Both of the films we're looking at tonight, the acting is good.
The acting is very good.
Dan Aykroyd got an Oscar nomination for Drive Miss Daisy, and he's got some scenes that are really good in this. It's just like, oh, of course, right? Dan Aykroyd's great. I love Dan Aykroyd. I met him around this era briefly at a Christmas tree lot, and I feel like I annoyed him.
And you were a child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he had just been in this film that was a bomb called Loose Cannons with Gene Hackman. And I said, oh, I just saw Loose Cannons. And he's like, aha, great. but I mean, he has some really fine scenes in this. And Jessica Tandy won the Oscar. Yeah, sure. I'm okay with some of this stuff. It's not as offensive as Green Book.
It's not as offensive as
Green Book. We're going to cover Green Book. We have to. And I'll put some of this aside for that, but that is fucking offensive that won as much as it did. This is less offensive. The writer of Green Book is a racist and an Islamophobe, whereas the writer of Miss Daisy,
it's like a playwright. It's like play some cool dude in New York. Let's look up. Who wrote Driving Miss Daisy?
Yeah. So he won the Pulitzer and the Tony and then the Oscar. It's a pretty it's a hefty trifecta right there.
It's Alfred Uri, who was writing memories of essentially his elderly grandmother.
Right.
Was what he was writing about, was family memories. So,
and the progressive thing is that they are a Jewish family, and I just feel, but there's also this sense that the Black people are still the other. There's an otherness, there's a separation. It's, had it been come at from both sides, where you have the scene, like there's a scene where it's Morgan Freeman and his granddaughter near the very end. But if you had seen interchanging scenes where, like, him talking to his wife or anyone, it's like someone scolding him for, he's getting older, you're going to drive around this old white woman. I don't know. Look, I don't want to be one of those old white Hollywood producers who are like, you should change this way and do this way. But I think that there could have been more, it could have been more introspective. It could have been more inclusive, as opposed to just a full on, this is a white family's vision of the South. That being said, this was a great year for a white person's vision of the South, or white person's vision of race relations in America. The same year, Glory. I think Glory was also up for.
Glory was up.
And, it's like, because I've always wondered what Ferris Bueller would have thought about the Civil War.
Now you know.
I do want to mention Kim Basinger's, she was nominated, she was up there for Best Picture, pardon me, and she went off script because Spike Lee hadn't been nominated, and let's just cut in her audio here.
Okay.
We've got five great films here, and they're great for one reason. Because they tell the truth. But there is one film missing from this list that deserves to be on it, because ironically, it might tell the biggest truth of all, and that's Do the Right Thing.
So it's pretty cool that Kim Basinger said that, and Spike Lee later thanked her for it. But I want to list out the other nominees for Best Picture the year that Driving Miss Daisy won. Okay. Dead Poets Society, Born on the 4th of July, Field of Dreams, and My Left Foot. Of those, I think, maybe Field of Dreams is the one that people talk about? But that's a pretty, My Left Foot, it's like Daniel Day-Lewis, that performance, that was his first Oscar. That was the thing that really broke him through. But I really, it's weird. It's a weird group of movies.
It is a weird group of movies. And all of them are movies that are of their time. They are movies that feel like the moment they were made, where right. In terms of the filmmaking style, in terms of just everything about them, whereas Do the Right Thing is ahead of its time. It's filmmaking, that's what makes it influential, it's what makes it taught in schools, it's what makes it remembered. But of course, best pictures are rarely, though sometimes, movies that are ahead of their time. They are often reflections on the past.
Yeah. Well, this is going to be one of our more rambling episodes, and I just before I pick my best scene in Driving Miss Daisy, there are some things that I do admire about it. I've already said that I liked Dan Aykroyd's performance, all the performances, and I didn't like the score. What was kind of fascinating is that it is a melodrama in total, but the parts are all so subdued and minimal it doesn't really get into histrionics. So they, you know, there's not, it's just, you know, a little bit of flares here and there, but it's all pretty small. Again, I'd be fascinated to see what this is on stage. I think it's a different beast. But yeah, it is a very polite film. Also, I think Jessica Tandy was the oldest person to win an Oscar at 80 years old.
She was,
which is cool. She's great in this. She's great in Cocoon. She's a great actor.
She's in Batteries Not Included too, isn't she?
Oh, is that right? God damn! It's so weird, like that 80s thing where it's like if you're Australian or if you're over 70, you can do a movie. I think that's all I got. We've talked about this enough. It's not offensive as much as I thought it would be, but it's I don't know, man. The thing where it's just like the music works and like the sadness and all, it's like cranks you up, and it's just, I don't like being manipulated without cause. Whereas Do the Right Thing from the fucking first frame of the opening credits, it's just so alive, and I get teary-eyed because it's just so goddamn great. It's fun, it's funny, it's sad, it's heartbreaking, it's life-giving. It is, again, one of my three or four most favorite films of all time. So, okay, my pick for best scene is a coin flip. Yeah, just that's a nice transition right there. My coin flips, all right, I'm just going to pick the unpopular pick, and it'll be the Thanksgiving scene at the very end of the film. Because the camera work is nice. It like just slowly pushes in on the two leads, and it really just frames them. And it's a nice thing. It's just ruined at the very end by an overlay of the old car driving through, and also Morgan Freeman feeding her. It's kind of like, oh, that's a little melodramatic, but they're both in fine shape, and they're really working. It's good. I think it's a good payoff. It's a good ending. It's yeah. There we go. Thanks, Ethan.
Great choice.
Oh gosh.
I think for me, it is such a flat movie that, you know, for some bad films, there are real highs and lows. Just a lot of lows with the occasional high. It's polite. It's just, it feels a lot longer than its runtime compared to Do the Right Thing, which feels shorter than its runtime. Do the Right Thing is a longer movie.
Yep.
But my favorite scene, I had a few in mind, and now I'm just debating in my head over what I want to be. Because this movie is almost just like a montage. It's not...
It's sort of montage the movie, yeah.
It's, you're lingering on years for a few minutes at a time. Yeah. I like the scene... Okay, my favorite scene, I'm gonna choose it.
Go for it.
Is when Morgan Freeman, they're driving to Mobile, and Morgan Freeman has to pee, and then they pulled over to the side of the road to pee, because there's a lot that happens there.
Yes.
It's one of the few times in the movie that the racism of the time is really directly discussed, where he's like, you know, I can't go to the bathroom in any of those service stations. And he refuses to let her like tell him not to go pee. And then it could just be like a simple scene, but then she gets afraid when he's not there. It's kind of afraid something's happened to him and afraid something's going to happen to her.
Yes.
And it adds some complexity to her character at that point. There's just something about, it's like, it's at that moment that they become more like friends. Because there's no longer like an employer relationship right. happening at that point. So I like that scene. Good I like pick, the, good some pick. Of the emotion of the scene that occurs there. I like some of what it's saying. So that's my best scene.
That's great. Yeah, I realize now. I remember what I was terrified that half of the film would be her teaching him how to read.
Yes, that would be my really, worst scene.
I was terrified that it was going to be. It's way less of a white savior film than you would think it would be.
It is, because it seems like at that point, I remember thinking,
I was like, no, I'm not going to watch this. I'm not going to watch this.
Because before that, it's kind of like a funny thing where he was trying to get her to like take a drive and she wouldn't. Yeah. It was like, oh, this is like a fun little comedy. And then
he's great. He is great. He deserved the Oscar nomination. And if you notice in the opening credits, he has top billing over her. And, you know, I mean, he was at this point a kind of unproven actor in cinema. And it's a weird film because I can't just flat out hate it the way that I can some other things that we're going to cover and have covered. But it's, I don't know. It's just not quite there.
It is not quite there.
Yeah. So maybe we'll have to watch the James Earl Jones, Angela Lansbury version, just to compare and contrast.
Yeah.
On a future episode.
I'd be very interested.
The next time Spike Lee loses an Oscar to some other car movie thing, we'll add that as our third film.
That's perfect. Classic for us to have three films. So I guess now comes the point in the podcast where we make that difficult choice of whether or not the best scene in the bad film is better or worse than the worst scene in the good film.
Yeah.
So who should go first?
I think mine requires more deliberation.
Okay.
So I'll go first. It's a little... I will go first.
Maybe we should save it for another episode.
All right,
leave people hanging.
To be continued. I think that when the scene in Do the Right Thing was filmed, Spike was still, he was 32. He was a young filmmaker. It was his third film, which is crazy. Like the level of confidence in every fucking shot in that film. Because Ernest Dickerson was really young too. It's just, it's like, what did I do? When I was 32, that's when I realized like I shouldn't drink vodka martinis because they make me sleepy. That's the one thing I learned by the time I was 32. So I think that like if he was to do it now, it would not be the same thing. Same with Rosie Perez versus the Thanksgiving scene at the end of Dragon Miss Daisy, which is the most melodramatic scene, I realize, because he's feeding her. And I almost picked the salmon scene from Dragon Miss Daisy. Which is a pretty good scene. But at the same time, is it a good scene? Because it's like, you're forcing the black character to prove that he's honest, and it's like that's fucked.
I mean, you're creating a situation where it's like,
yeah,
and Do the Right Thing. Every character is a character. Nobody in this movie is perfect, and there's no like clear lines of this person is absolutely in the right for anything to happen. This person is. There's complexity. There's nuance. There's humanity. Whereas in Driving Miss Daisy, everyone's kind of a caricature. Like Morgan Freeman's character is like so perfect and charming.
Yes.
That he lacks nuance.
Yeah, even his laughter, it's like, it's perfectly nuanced. Yeah, again, that said, I'm glad he got an Oscar nomination for this.
He's still.
I think that his performance in Glory is more challenging, maybe complex. All right, so what I'm looking at Thanksgiving versus the. I feel like I've put myself in a corner that I don't want to be in on either side.
You definitely did.
Like, I don't want to vote for either of them. I don't know, man. Am I an asshole if I vote for Driving Miss Daisy?
You're not, because it's still the bad film.
Yeah, and I always vote for the bad film, but this is different. I don't want to vote against my favorite movie or one of my favorite movies.
No, so you just want to vote for Rosie Perez being uncomfortable in a scene.
I am heartened by that, you know, she came around and you know, she was there for the Weinstein trial stuff. And we were talking about, I was talking about Dead Poets Society earlier, and that director, Peter Weir, made a film, I think she got an Oscar nomination for it. It's different time. I'm just trying to like
your time you're...
before having to make it. Yeah, I really don't want to do
stalling.
All right. So I'm just going to side on the side of history. I'm going to do the right thing.
All right.
Yeah, and I'll be fine. Well, I'm fine with it.
Fine. So the worst scene, Do the Right Thing, is still better than the best scene in Driving Miss Daisy.
But again, I want to say that, you know, I didn't hate Driving Miss Daisy. Well, okay, that's not fair. I hated quite a bit of it. But it wasn't as racist as I... all right, you know, forget it. I don't want to talk about that movie anymore.
That's fair.
Richard, go for it.
I'll go for it. So I'll continue your thought there. Driving Miss Daisy, there's a moment that we briefly talked about where they're at the graveyard, and she asks him, he'll place some flowers on someone else's grave, and he says, which one is it? Where is it? And he clearly can't read.
Yeah.
And then it's at that point that it feels like, fuck, here we go.
Yes.
It's been like a light comedy, and now we're about to get...
I thought it was going to be a half hour of her teaching him how to read.
Yes. And instead it wasn't. He just learned how to read in the off screen, which was better, much better choice. And I thought we were getting to this point where she was going to find her humanity through being his savior. And that did not happen, at least not on screen. So that seemed like they made a good choice there, because I thought it was going to be a movie that went the other direction.
I said, "Ah, fuck!" out loud.
That's exactly what I said too.
Fuck, white savior. Here we go.
And it didn't. It didn't do it. So, congratulations to Driving Miss Daisy for that.
Yeah.
So for me, it's the scene with Sal and Jade. She eats pizza, and he uncomfortably flirts with her, and then it's the scene in Driving Miss Daisy where Morgan Freeman needs to pee. And pulls the car over, and they have a conversation about why he's going to have to pee right here. It's a great scene. But I am going to choose Do the Right Thing, because
yes,
the cinematography is too good. The acting's too good. The depth of the characters are just, it's everything is just too good. It's the movies don't exist on the same plane. No scene in the Driving Miss Daisy is filmed with the sort of skill that you find in Do the Right Thing. The artistry is not there. The acting is good, but it's like just thinking about that scene in the car, just the way it's shot. It could be like a TV movie that's just shot on more expensive film. And so it lacks artistry, whereas every frame of Do the Right Thing has artistry and skill behind it. And there's nothing really wrong with the scene. It just kind of creeps me out. So it's still not a bad scene. So as a result, Do the Right Thing.
No.
The worst scene is better than the best scene.
Yeah. Every scene in Do the Right Thing helps weave its weird tapestry.
It does.
So
it's all building up to that night. And it's does an amazing job getting there. So I think we've chosen.
Wow. All right. There we go. Two for Do the Right Thing, please. Terrific.
So in lieu of an award
of a prize,
we would instead like to focus on a couple of things that you could do to actually help the world be a better place. And I know, George, you have some nonprofits listed out that you wanted to mention, sure, to call out. If you want to go through that list.
AWU and LACP, there are local chapters in a lot of places. Look around. There might be one very close to where you live. There's also the Southern Poverty Law Center, which this is something that should not get neglected, the Trevor Project. So it's thetrevorproject.org. And it's a great charity. All of these are important. If you can give to any of them or all of them, I mean, Jesus Christ, that's helping. You're really making an impact in the world. So those are the ones that I have this week. I'll have more next time we meet up.
And I'll add to that list. There's a lot of places out right now that will pay bail for people who've been arrested.
Oh, yes.
Connected to protests. You can easily find, it's hard to just choose one to call out. You can easily find long lists of these. Cash bail is one of the great injustices of our society, since it allows the wealthy to easily get out of prison pre-trial and leaves people in prison who can't afford to pay their bills sometimes for years before they're even tried for what are often minor crimes. So I would look into also giving money, if you have it, to a charity, to a nonprofit organization that will pay bail, particularly for people who've been involved in the protests. And you should also look into why there's been a big thing in New York where they finally were going to end cash bail, and then there was a big backlash from prosecutors and the police I would encourage you to look into why cash bail, even Joe Biden referred to cash bail as a modern day debtor's prison. And if Joe Biden can get behind the progressive cause, then you can too. So
look at and if you want more ammunition behind that, just Google Kalief Browder. It's Kalief, last name Browder. Get ready to get your fucking heart broken, because that's the American justice system. So we have a Better Days Are Somewhere Ahead of Us podcast coming up, and I don't know, everybody, shit's bad. It's not going to get better, but we have to all be together and work and fight and not give up. And again, fuck being polite. 1989, the number, another summer. Sound of the funky drummer. Music hitting your heart, because I know you got soul.